Good morning, diners and travelers. Welcome to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to be talking today about, you know, rabbit, I don't know. We have a whole bunch of different things.
Well, it's sort of the usual
hodgepodge.
Hodgepodge. I was going to say potpourri, whatever it is.
Okay.
All great people. You're going to love the coffee press. You're going to love the book about meat. And then what could be wrong with two wonderful books about grilling from a rather different point of view? So that's what's on today's program. And starting out, we have Alan Adler, who invented not a new spacecraft, but a space-age coffee press.
Which we find every day, first thing in the morning, is on the menu.
And he makes a wonderful cup of coffee, and you're going to want to know all about it and how to get one.
It would be very unlikely that Alan Adler, who's our guest now at On the Menu Radio, is related to the only Adler I ever knew, who was a British musician who played the mouth organ, or the harmonica. And his first name was Larry. Now, you're not a distant cousin, are you?
No, I'm not, but as a kid, he was so famous that I was encouraged to take up the harmonica, which I did.
Oh, so you did know him?
No, I didn't know him, but he was well-famous.
No, but you knew the name, though.
People associated my last name with harmonicas.
Isn't that amazing? It's really funny. Growing up, there was a television news reader who had the same name as me, Peter Haig. Now, we're not easily mistaken for each other because he was bald and had a big black mustache. But it was interesting to have a namesake who was, at least, if he wasn't famous, at least he was in everybody's households every evening. But that's not why we're talking today. We're talking today about what would, when we first read about it, we said, we can't believe this is true. How many ways are there to make coffee? How many gadgets are there that say they're the best? Why would somebody go to all this trouble to create a new one? So why don't you pick up the story from there, Alan?
Well, of course, we'll be talking today about the AeroPress, which I invented about 5 years ago. I think it's interesting to talk a little bit about the history of coffee brewing. Oh, by the way, I should probably start by saying that the AeroPress is a small press, which sits on your mug and allows you to press one or two cups of coffee in about a minute. And depending on the way you do it, you can make coffee from espresso strength to American strength or even weaker if you like. The way it works is that you set the press on a mug, put a ground coffee into the press, add hot water, stir for about 10 seconds, and then press with a plunger, which compresses the air above the slurry of coffee and water and pushes the liquid down through the bottom of the press and through a paper filter, which removes all the grit and into your cup. And that all takes less than a minute. Then you have something in your cup which is espresso strength, and if you want to drink espresso or make a latte with the concentrated coffee, and if you drink American strength coffee, that's typically about one-fourth the intensity of espresso, so you would just add hot water to the cup and you're done.
Now, the miracle of this whole thing is, in fact, that the coffee ends up being delicious and not at all bitter.
Yeah, the reason for that is that the wet time is very short, and you're free to use any temperature that works best. We did a lot of experiments on professional tasters, and we brewed coffee with them in an AeroPress using various water temperatures, and they ended up all choosing water that was 175 degrees Fahrenheit, which is considerably cooler than most brewing is done. Now, people, when they first heard about that, said, oh, you can't possibly brew coffee at only 175. And my answer has always been, well, you're free to use any water temperature you like, but you really owe it to yourself to at least try 175 because that's what everybody liked best.
Well, we agree with you. There's really no doubt. And using a higher temperature really does sort of bake the coffee. Now, I did meet some people from Peet's, P-E-E-T-S, the famous coffee roaster who told the person who founded Starbucks everything they know, and they did say let the water go off the boil, but only by a very few degrees. So I think you have exactly the right approach, and we're finding that it not only does it preserve the flavor juice beautifully, but it also means you don't have to wait so long to drink it.
Yes. Well, let me talk just a minute about the history of coffee brewing.
Okay.
Please.
It began by throwing some ground coffee in a pot and boiling it for an hour. And some people still do it that way, called cowboy coffee.
Oh, yes.
And it is the most horribly bitter thing you've ever drunk. You wonder why anybody would even choose to drink coffee, considering what it tastes like.
Now, my mother actually used to make it that way. Way back 65 years ago in England, that's exactly how she would go about making coffee. And it really didn't taste very good. You're perfectly correct.
And maybe the next step after that might be viewed as the percolator, where the percolator sat on your stovetop and boiled for, perhaps 12, 15 minutes. And the liquid was recycled through the same bed of grounds many times over that period. And that also made pretty strong and pretty bitter coffees. And then a pretty huge leap in taste quality was to go from running the water through the grounds many, many times to a single time, and that's what the automatic drip machine, that's the most common way. Automatic drip machine is turned on, and the water is boiled, and the action of boiling pushes the water up through a siphon tube and drips it onto a bed of coffee grounds. It goes through one time and into your carafe or your cup.
That's the classic Mr. Coffee, or the equivalent thereof, right?
Right. And that probably comprises 98% of home brewing today.
Okay. Now, what about the method that I guess the coffee lovers of the Pacific Northwest seem to favor most, which is one pass through a paper filter in a cone. So you have a paper cone, and you have a ceramic cone frame, and then you put the paper in the cone, and then you put the coffee in the paper. So it's a one-time through drip.
Yeah, that's the thing that was favored when I was young. Yeah.
Yes. Well, compared to the automatic drip, it has a couple of advantages. One advantage is that you can use whatever temperature of water you like.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And I first discovered 175-degree water made the best-tasting coffee brew that way, with a cone. It has another advantage in that it's easier to stir the coffee and the water together, in the grounds and the water together, in the cone while it's dripping through.
Right.
And I believe that's probably the second best way to make a cup of coffee after the AeroPress. And that's the way I started out, actually. But I was struck by the fact that the wet time, the drip-through time, was on the order of 4 or 5 minutes.
Well, that's the same with the French press, right?
Well, on the French press, you have the opportunity to press immediately if you like, but I can explain why people don't do that. But let me just stay with the drip cone just for a moment longer. You're just relying on gravity to push the water down through the grounds, and that takes 4 or 5 minutes. And during that time, a lot of acidity and bitterness is going into your cup. So I looked at that, and I started trying to think of a way to shorten the wet time, because I believed that a shorter wet time would make a sweeter-tasting cup. And that's what led to the AeroPress. The press time with the AeroPress is something in the order of 30 seconds because you're compressing the air above the bed of coffee. So the huge benefit of the AeroPress over the drip cone is that you can cut that wet time down to something that's about optimal.
Okay, so you started fiddling around with this and then came up with the answer, and then you had to get somebody to make it.
Right. Now, I owned the company Araby already.
What is Araby? I don't even know.
Oh, well, the Araby Flying Ring was our first product. It's thrown like a disc or a frisbee and set the Guinness World Record for the world's longest throw. And it came out in 1984. And
it's a toy.
Yes, although it's also viewed as sporting goods.
Yeah, game.
In fact,
the majority of
Arabies are found in sporting goods retail.
Okay, well, now I understand the wet. I couldn't figure out why I was looking up a coffee system, and I kept finding those Frisbees.
Yes, and we had a line of about 15 or so boarding toys. And I started out just experimenting in my kitchen and my shop. I have a shop adjacent to my house with ways to make a better cup of coffee with absolutely no intent of making it a commercial product. But it turned out so good that people who tasted it, including Alex Tennant, our general manager, said, we really ought to produce and sell these things. It was a rather big leap for us because we were organized to sell to the sporting goods market, and we had to develop new contacts in order to reach coffee and home kitchen supply stores.
Well, listeners, you're getting a real live endorsement from Ann and Peter. Ann has, over the last couple of years, complained sometimes
that she was really
going off coffee and what kind was I using
it was making
this time,
me sick.
And the acid was upsetting her stomach, and now we have the answer. So what's the answer for everyone who now knows they need to get one, Alan? How do they lay their hands on one?
Well, if you want to walk into a store, one chain that has them is Sur La Table. They have about 50 stores around the U.S.
Okay.
Many stores that sell housewares carry them. If you shop on the Internet, Amazon is our biggest single supplier.
Oh, great. Okay, that's easy.
You can read reviews on Amazon. There are over 750 five-star reviews on Amazon for the AeroPress. It's the highest-rated coffee maker they sell. You can Google AeroPress and probably come up with hundreds of places to buy it besides Amazon. Just for fun, I'm going to Google AeroPress as we speak.
And that's AeroPress, right?
Yes, and I got 449,000 results. Now, that doesn't mean there are 449,000 retailers, but there are many.
But the website is AeroBIE.com, which is the company name.
Oh, by the way, I should have told you that if you go to AeroBIE.com, there's a place right on the opening page to click for retailers.
Oh, good.
Great. So you can put in your zip code and find one close by.
That's right.
Yeah, the only thing, as I said, that you need to find out how you can make a larger quantity so that we don't have to keep making it first thing in the morning.
Yes, well, let me touch on that briefly. The AeroPress will do up to 4 scoop pressings, but as I was chatting with Peters before you even started the recording, it does take a long time to press 4 scoops, probably a couple of minutes. 3 scoops is more in the order of a minute, and that's enough for 2 large mugs, 2 mugs that would hold perhaps 7 or 8 ounces. If you want to make coffee for guests, for example, a carafe full of coffee, what I usually do is I do 2 or 3 pressings of 3 scoops each, and I dump that concentrate into the carafe, and I just leave it alone. I do this before the guests arrive. And then we have dinner. And by the way, that process I just described takes me about 3 to 5 minutes. Then after dinner, I add hot water to the carafe, which, of course, just takes a minute. So that's one way to make more coffee.
Uh-huh.
But we do get requests for some way to make more than a single 1 or 2 cups, and perhaps someday we'll address that. Although I've described one way to address it right now, and I also think that probably 80% of coffee brewing need is met with the current AeroPress size.
Well, Alan, you're to be congratulated. I mean, you indeed built a better mousetrap, and the world is undoubtedly beating a path to your door, and coffee lovers across the world will thank you for that, just as we are doing now. So thank you so much for joining us today and On the Menu.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed speaking to both of you, Ann and Peter.
Thanks, Alan.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And we're back. And who's up next?
Yeah, well, this is the ultimate resource book on meat and butchering. And
With recipes, of course.
With recipes. And so totally thorough. It's called Primal Cuts. And here we're talking to its author.
Marisa Gugiani has written a book that is so rich in content, you just have to have it. It's called Primal Cuts, Cooking with America's Best Butchers. And in it, you've got profiles of chefs, profiles of butchers, profiles of growers, recipes, directions on how to raise your own chickens, just about everything.
Hold on, if you're a vegetarian or vegan,
you can turn off the chef.
You can turn off this program right now, and you will find very useful.
No. But looking through the book, I saw your animals with the diagrams of the cuts.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of when we lived in Australia, lamb was so cheap. I think we paid something like $2.50 for half of a lamb, but I would take my little diagram and I would go into the butcher shop and go over how I wanted everything cut. And so everybody used to run away. All the butchers would run away from me when I walked in.
Seriously, and came into the shop, and all of a sudden they were all dealing with a different customer.
That demanding lady.
Yes, this is true.
But you can imagine it was to have fresh spring lamb it truly was $2.50 Australian for a whole side of about 12 or 13 pounds.
Absolutely insane.
Well, it's not that way now, but this was in the 70s.
Amazing how much lamb you can eat, and that's the price, even two people.
Yeah.
Well, now, Marisa, where do we start with this? I wanted to say that this book is so up to the minute on trend that I picked it up and leafed through it, and I ran into all these friends of mine, chefs and butchers and mm-hmm. restaurateurs. So it shows, I mean, not 5 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. 6 years ago would not have been the case at all, would it?
No.
No, but it's really hot now.
Yeah, I think it's a culmination of the focus on local food systems. The story here is that these butchers that I'm profiling are buying meat from local farms. And in order to do that, they need to buy the whole animal because farms don't sell boxes of meat. They sell animals. And you need a butcher's skill set to deal with that and turn it into meat that's delicious and profitable. So these sort of local food systems are cropping up, and they're starting to mature and develop, over the last several years.
Now, this is absolutely the opposite of Iowa beef processors, right?
Yeah.
This is the opposite.
Absolutely.
This is Polyphase Farms in Virginia. Mm-hmm. This is dozens of other farms that you know across the country.
Absolutely.
So it's like a second system almost.
Yeah. I mean, what happens, there's lots of small farms all over the country, and most of them are, even if they're a small, idyllic-looking farmer, are involved in the commercial food system. They animals get put on a truck, once a year, twice a year, and they go to a feedlot and then processed in one of the huge commercial processing plants in the Midwest or the South, usually. And so instead of that, these farms are starting to sell to local consumers, and they're selling their product at a higher value. Not going to a feedlot, but it means that they're going to the slaughterhouse maybe every week or every couple weeks, and they're having to market their products, and they're having to always find a home for it every week, and they get a little bit more money, but it's a lot more work, and so this whole community crops up to sort of find a home for these animals and help the farms and create markets for it.
And those are the people who are the stars of your book.
Yeah, the people that are the stars of my book, but also, the farmers markets that are gaining steam, and all kinds of restaurateurs that are, instead of picking up the phone and calling Cisco and having one big truck pull up to the back of the restaurant once a week, they're talking to 20 purveyors. They've got a watercress guy, they've got a chicken guy, they've got their mushroom forager, and it's a lot more work, but it means that there's a story behind the food. It means that everybody in the food chain is making money instead of just a couple people at the top.
Now, just for our listeners that don't know, could you just explain your involvement with all this? What is your background and your family business?
Sure. My family has been in food distribution for the last 50 years. My grandpa was a butcher, and in 2005, my parents bought a meat processing plant, and so I started running it from the beginning, and we buy whole animals from local farms and sell to restaurants and grocery stores in Sonoma County in Northern California. First bought the business, basically what we were doing was buying Australian lamb by the truckload and cutting it up into stew meat and other cuts, boneless cuts, and then shipping them off in huge containers to a few hotels in Las Vegas. That was our whole business model.
You were part of the old system, and then you became part of the new system.
Yeah, I just, you know, I would drive to work and see these little lambs, and I just thought, where are those guys gone? Like, what's up with those lambs? Why am I buying lamb from Australia? And I had this sort of slow dawning of realization. And so I asked my dad, you know, like, okay, if I'm running this place, can I sort of experiment and buy from some local farmers and just see what happens? And it slowly became our whole model over the course of a couple of years.
Now, how did you get to be a butcher in the first place? I mean, or a meat packer or whatever you would characterize yourself as. This is not, I hate to sound sexist or anything like that, but this is not really a very feminine career.
Well, there's an increase in women butchers.
I understand there's an increase in women chefs too, but there's only four in the world that have three Michelin stars, so it's still
it's a macho culture. I mean, if it became 50% women, it's still a macho culture, but it still surprises me that this is the narrow world that I'm in. I'm a writer, and I was, before I was running Sonoma Direct, I was living in New York writing plays. And
well, that's what I wanted to get to also. The thing about this book that makes it really so special is how well you write.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, and because it's, if we break it down, we have all those sections I mentioned, but when you're doing the individual profiles, you have a little snapshot of the person you're profiling, and then more or less a narrative from that person. And it's just such a step above what you'd expect from somebody who doesn't have a writing background.
Yeah, writing is really a passion of mine, and I do a lot of food writing.
Yeah, and you do a lot of this. Is that the word I'm doing?
Yeah, activism.
Activism work as well. Advocacy is the word I wanted.
There you go.
Advocacy. Do you want to just sort of pick out a couple of these people? Because they're all such characters.
Yeah.
How about Donald Link? Isn't he wonderful?
I love his restaurant. Yeah. My experience of going to New Orleans was, I'd never been there before, but when I was on the plane and when I was out the night before, I kept hearing his name. Everyone is talking about this guy. Everyone is planning to go to his restaurants, and he's really the talk of the town. I mean, his restaurants are so popular and so highly regarded. And so I got to go to Cochon Butcher, which is
newish
butcher shop. I guess it's a couple years old now, and the staff there was so nice, and they took me out on the town and were just like so warm and gracious. And he told me all about his family history, and his family has this huge rice empire. They're rice farmers, and so his roots in Louisiana food are deep. And I was moved by the fact that he said that the post-Katrina world of Louisiana had become much more focused on local food and local farmers because they realized that they really needed to support each other, and that the bonds and the relationships there are vital, and their lives depend on helping one another out. And so he had been really moved to start buying from local farms and making it work. And so that was really touching.
Well, he's understated as a personality, too. He's sort of a little shy, even, don't you think?
He's a little shy, but he has a very lively, sarcastic wit.
Oh, yes, he does.
once you crack the surface, he's really funny. He's really sarcastic, which is a trait of restaurant people that I really like. They're all smartasses.
Now, he's a chef, restaurant-turned butcher as part of his empire now. A real-life butcher.
I have to go with, there's several in there that are really great meat cutters, but my favorite is Jarrett Vandenord, who's the butcher at Sonoma Direct, our business, and there's just not a better butcher. I mean,
what's his name again?
Some on par. Jarrett Vandenord.
Vandenord. Is he in, he's in the book? I haven't seen him.
Yeah, he's the second to last in the book, and he's Dutch, and he's just had a very colorful life. When he was a teenager, he was basically adopted by a butcher and his wife, and he started cutting meat, and they lived upstairs, and he would cut meat as a kid, and they would take the scraps upstairs for dinner, and they took care of him. He's had a lot of other adventures in life. He's been an antiques dealer, and he ran away with some hippies in Paris in the 60s, and
isn't
he was in the military. And
you have a lot of them in here with this very diverse backgrounds.
Absolutely. I mean,
but tell me this. Here he is. I'm looking at his picture, and he has a tattoo, not as many as Chris Cosentino, but all the pictures of these hunky butchers that we see all have tattoos, usually sleeves.
We've contemplated a calendar.
Yeah.
Hot butcher calendar.
Yeah.
Some super macho culture. And it's like the military, there's a lot of, the tattoos are a part of that. They're the toughness to it and part of the character, you know, and the people that it draws in.
So there are a whole lot of fascinating stories indeed. We forgot to mention, we should have, of course, this is not only a storybook about butchers, it's also a cookbook. So
and
there are
delicious
recipes. So there are lots of great non-vegan recipes for you,
I want to enjoy.
Yep.
I want to get some necks from Jamison Farms and do that Chris Cosentino's recipe for braised lamb necks.
Okay.
Yeah, I love lamb necks. Pork necks, too. There's a lot of meat on them. It's a pain for, you know, a butcher's not going to pull the meat off of it because it's tedious work. But if you're someone who likes to pick at bones, which I definitely have that proclivity.
Yeah, me too. Maybe it's just Italian genes.
Maybe. Italian peasants.
we
always fight over the neck at holidays.
we used to get a cut when I was growing up in England called Best End of Neck. And it was mutton, and it was sort of a little bit like chops. They were like poor man's chops, except there were two bones that didn't quite meet in them. That was not intended to be a pun. I guess I've been against lamb necks for a long time, but we have had them before, and if you want to get them, sweetheart, we'll certainly, if you get some, Mike, certainly we'll fix them for you.
It's really hard. I mean, we personally know some lamb growers, and we have two really fine ones in southwestern Pennsylvania. But it's an issue of the cost of inspecting for these parts that are not the straight chops and stuff, all the extra bits.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we used to get all the kidneys, all the livers, and everything we wanted until they started having to charge extra for, what's it called, floor kill or something, or floor, no. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, the slaughterhouses don't actually usually make any money on the kill. They make their profit on aggregating all the extra parts and selling them off in bulk. So now they charge farmers more if you want to keep that stuff. It's a higher kill charge.
Well, that's not very good because that goes directly against the idea of using the whole animal.
Yeah, I know.
Except, I guess,
for the local guys, if you want to get your offal and your head and your, it's like the movies, you know, they don't make money on the tickets, they make money on the concessions. The
right.
tickets just aren't enough to kind of let them scrape by, so.
And that's why we can't have calories listed for popcorn, movie house popcorn.
Put them out of business.
Right. Well, Marisa, it's been delightful talking to you, and I think that this is a great book, and I think it's going to be useful to people who are concerned with this. Well, with deliciousness as well as humanity, what else? Everything, ethical treatment of animals, everything, and the health of us and the planet. So I think everybody should rush out and get that.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Do you know, by the way, a book called Good Meat?
I do, yeah.
We interviewed her.
a great book.
Yeah, so we're really producing a lot of good material, so there's no excuse for ignorance in this day and age.
So there you are.
So there you are.
So it's called Primal Cuts, and it's got nothing to do with the movies. It's all about meat. Marisa, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Thank you. Okay.
Ciao, Marisa.
Bye-bye.
So hang in with us while we take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are, and we have another new concept for you. It's called Japanese grilling. Not actually that the Japanese don't grill, because they've grilled for centuries. But it's all about Japanese seasonings and Western-style grilling, sort of. Let's just listen to the author of Japanese Grilling.
I love learning something new, and I also like finding something that should be so obvious that there's something wrong and I didn't recognize it.
Huh. Well, I think it's funny. I was just talking to a gentleman about Korean cooking. Another world, deep, deep world that I know, you know, maybe a hair about, but it's just, yeah, it's so interesting. So this kind of encountering different food cultures.
Korean chefs have Japanese sushi places.
Hold on a second. Let's get this in the right order, because we have another male voice guest, but nobody has any idea who he is.
Yes. Okay. We are talking to Harris Salat. He, with his friend and colleague, Tadashi Ono, who is a chef and obviously of Japanese origin, wrote this absolutely revelatory book called The Japanese Grill, From Classic Yakitori to Steak, Seafood, and Vegetables. And Harris, as I said to you off air, there are ingredients here that you explained so thoroughly. You're very, very clear in how you present things, including ingredients, and I thought I was pretty well versed on Japanese cuisine, and you have ingredients here that I never heard of.
Well, first, thank you so much for having me, and I really appreciate your kind words about our book. You know, I think as Americans, for most of us, our encounter with Japanese starts with sushi, right? Which is a really wonderful way to think about Japanese cooking, because all the ingredients and the fundamental flavors and sensibilities of Japanese cooking come out of sushi. But one of the great revelations for me when I started to travel to Japan and study the food and food culture there, I became fascinated with Japanese food a little over a decade ago, I guess. And one of the things that really surprised me when I started to go to Japan and study the cooking was how tiny a part sushi was of this unbelievably deep and varied cuisine. And that's how I started to get exposed to all these ingredients that you're talking about. But these are such wonderful ingredients. And one of the things that I love about Japanese ingredients is that they rely on fermentation for some of the most basic things like miso and soy sauce, but other things like yuzu kosho, which is this...
And that's one that I have to get a hold of to play with.
Yuzu kosho is really like the secret weapon.
Is that hard
for grilling
to get?
For us.
Is it hard to get?
No, actually, you can find it on Amazon.
Okay.
Just type in yuzu kosho, K-O-S-H-O. It's fermented with chilies, salt, and yuzu zest and juice. And yuzu is an incredibly aromatic citrus.
Yeah, I love it.
Oh, so do I. And I think they're even growing yuzu now on the West Coast.
But I said this is something we should have all thought about. I mean, the essence of this book is it's American grilling with Japanese flavors. Right.
Well, yes. I mean, we tried to cover a little bit of ground in this book, a number of different things. First, we wanted to introduce our audience to traditional Japanese grilling, like yakitori or shioyaki, which is salt grilling, especially for fish and seafood. You know, yaki onigiri, grilled rice balls, all these really wonderful traditional techniques of grilling in Japan. But also, Tadashi and I, Tadashi's a chef of one of New York's great Japanese restaurants called Matsuri, and we became friends a number of years ago. Yeah, it's a lovely place. And my wife and I, and now our little boy, you know, we come over to Tadashi's house, and in the summers, on Sundays, the man grills. And he's been in America for about 25 years. I tell you that he came here because he wanted to surf in California. That's a whole different story. Growing up in Japan, he's like, I want to be a surfer. But when he got here, he fell in love with American grilling. Then he looked back at his own cultural context, and of course, he's a professional chef, and he started to think about how he's creating flavor on the grill. And started to grill American style steak, half a chicken, pork chops,
yeah,
ribs,
which you'd never see in Japan. I mean,
you don't see in Japan.
Yeah,
I mean,
you
think
get,
about it.
I'm thinking of that. What's the, those? I can't remember. Benihana, those kind of places.
Right.
They do shrimp. Aren't
they? Right.
The ones
well, yeah. I mean,
shrimp?
Benihana is really interesting that they, you know, kind of brought this teppanyaki, like grilling on this flat on a flat top, basically.
That's the first exposure to Japanese food I ever had.
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, and
yes,
it was.
Me too.
Yeah, and it's part of this great showmanship, right? But yeah, I mean, you got to think about Japan as also a chopstick culture. So chopsticks are really amazing instruments, right? They're very precise.
But you don't use them with steak.
Exactly. You can't pick up a steak with a chopstick. You can pick up a piece of a steak. So
exactly.
Then you have grilled like shaved beef grilled is really wonderful in Japan, and we have some recipes for that. You know, a big old steak is really American. And one of the things I saw coming over to Tadashi's house is his grilling is unbelievably delicious. And he's grilling like things that I know about, you know, porterhouse, New York strip, or, you know, whole chicken roasting or something like that. But flavors are unbelievable. And then he introduced me to his marinade. We were talking about yuzu kosho. And like we have a recipe in the book for yuzu kosho scallops. They're incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can do that also pan sear in the kitchen too.
Hold up just a second, guys. There's one thing that worries me at the beginning of the book.
Okay.
Which is that you say when you're cooking according to this book, you can't use American style charcoal briquettes. You have to use some kind of natural charcoal from Japan.
No, he doesn't say that.
He does say that. I read it in the book.
Well, Peter, I'm sure, personal philosophy. I think you could use whatever you like. I think that food tastes better if you can find like lump charcoal, natural charcoal, or even we've seen all natural briquettes. But I'm just not crazy about the ones that are made with paraffin and all kinds of other stuff because it's, burning and coming into your food. The thing is, to cook the food in this book, and one of the things that Tadashi and I really wanted to make sure when we wrote this cookbook, because we want people to cook. It's like, get the Weber out, use whatever charcoal you want to use, or the gas grill, and just start grilling. And we throw in a couple of things for the aficionados, and we talk about Japanese grills, and Japanese have a special kind of charcoal called binchotan.
That's what I want to get a hold of. It sounds fabulous.
Oh, my God. It burns super hot. So it just cooks food really differently. And Japanese chefs believe it creates umami, you know, this savoriness, just by the way it transforms food and how the heat radiation or the rays. Sorry, I'm not a scientist. Where's Harold McGee? But how it kind of comes through, you know, it cooks and heats through the food. But you know, binchotan is really, it's a very natural charcoal. It looks like branches because it is branches. I think it takes a week for it to convert into charcoal. And it's so hard that when you clink it together, it's like glass. It sounds like glass. On the other side, it's really hard to light. So you actually, like I do it actually on my stove. Like I put a metal grate on the stove and just try to light the binchotan and then, go to town.
Do you have a source for that? You do have finding ingredients.
Yes. There are a couple of places. There is a wonderful shop in New York with a great website that you can order online. It's called Corinne Trading, and it's KORIN. It's a company founded by a woman named Saori Kawano, who is really a groundbreaking Japanese immigrant entrepreneur in America, who introduced us to Japanese kitchen knives, etc. And anyway, Saori sells binchotan, and she sells these great traditional Japanese grills that are kind of encased in earthenware. And, you know, they really retain heat. They're wonderful. So you can find the traditional stuff at a place like Corinne or I don't think they have online, but there's also a place in New York called the Japanese Culinary Center. And I'm sure there are other spots around the country as well. But Corinne, you can order from anywhere.
See, you said you're trying to make things easy for us to cook. And I think it's true.
For me too.
I mean, you have like three basic marinades.
Right.
And
right.
Tell us what those are.
Okay. So one of the things that Tadashi and I thought is, hey, what can you make and keep in the fridge and have it ready at a moment's notice for when you want to start grilling? So we thought, okay, there are a lot of great recipes in this book, but if you can, you know, if you want to prepare three things and have it ready, you can just start grilling at any time. One is a garlic soy sauce marinade for all red meat. The other is a yuzu kosho marinade, which is that wonderful yuzu kosho ingredient that we were talking about for chicken, pork, and fish. And then we have an all-purpose vegetable marinade for veggies. And they're really simple. They're kind of a crossover. They're not traditional in the sense that the garlic soy sauce marinade is garlic, soy sauce, and olive oil. And yuzu kosho marinade is, let me try to remember, yuzu kosho, olive oil, and soy sauce.
Yeah, you said that olive oil now is starting to be used a lot in Japan.
Yeah, you know, olive oil is, Japan, like any other place, the cuisine, the culture, nothing stays in stasis, you know, and it kind of has embraced, Japan actually for centuries millennia has embraced things from the outside world, you know, this island archipelago that's in the middle of the ocean. And in fact, if you trace the history of things, you know, tofu, soy sauce, miso, that comes from mainland China originally and was brought over with Buddhism. So Japan has long brought great, you know, foods over to their country and made it their own. Japanese curry, for example, which I believe came with a trade between the British Navy and the Japanese Navy in the 19th century or something
That sounds right. Now, it's really funny. I remember once meeting an olive oil producer, and we talked about extra virgin and all that kind of stuff, and he said, and then there's the last oil you can get when you're actually crushing the olives to death, and it's called pumice.
Huh.
And he said, curiously enough, there's a big market for pumice in Japan.
In Japan, yeah.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Well, we thought that why not think about how to integrate olive oil, such a great building block of a marinade. So, yeah, so that's you know, we started to use it, and it's just great. You know, and these marinades are so easy, like the yuzu kosho marinade. It's really a must-have. And, you know, the thing about it, these marinades rely on fermented ingredients again. They don't spoil easily. You know, once you make a marinade, it can sit in the fridge for a month, and then you can just brush it on, which is...
Just to make sure everybody understands, we have the basics, Japanese ingredients, where all these ingredients are explained, demystified, I might add. You have the tools, the essential tools, indispensable tools, you call it, for the grilling. Then you go into different types of grilling.
I love your bricks covered in foil.
Well, you know, Peter, when I told Japanese friends that, you know, we're going to do a yakitori section in this grill book, and some of my friends thought I was nuts, because in Japan, you can find great yakitori joints everywhere, and you just go have yakitori. I don't know if I've met anyone who, like, you know, sets up a grill to make yakitori. But yakitori is not that widespread in the United States, which is a shame because it's such a wonderful way to grill. And we thought, hey, you can do this at home, and you can do this on a backyard grill. You just have to set it up. And then we came up with this, did some research and thought about it, and had the foil-wrapped bricks as our secret solution here.
I think it's a great scheme because it lets you think about using your good old Weber kettle grill, which you already have, so you don't have to go out and buy another grill.
Absolutely not. No, it's great. And, you know, and the beautiful thing about yakitori is that you grill the meat and then you grill the marinade. And that's really the secret. And we saw a lot of yakitori recipes online, and we actually kind of use an inspired yakitori way of grilling for a number of different recipes. But with yakitori, you want to, let's say, the classic chicken yakitori. Yakitori means grilled bird, literally.
Oh, I thought that was funny. I never knew that. Yeah.
Yeah. But it kind of encompasses all of yakitori, which could include pork, vegetables, beef now.
Yeah, you include some other, they're not necessarily traditional grilling stuff for the steaks, although, I mean, you do beef liver, beef tongue. I really didn't know how you could do the beef tongue. I mean, our recipes for beef tongue, it takes 2 hours or something.
Well, you know, first of all, you have to marinate it for 2 days.
Yeah. Well,
you have to brine it for 2 days.
Right.
but that's the French way.
Right. Well, you see, if you're now cooking on skewers in Japan, it's thin slices of beef tongue, mm-hmm. and then you have different parts. I mean, I grew up eating beef tongue. My parents weren't born in America, I used to scare my friends in school with just bringing in the entire, like, you know, front of the tongue. But we loved it. But, you know, in Japan, you have these thin slices. Well, thinly sliced meat all together, and so it grills really fast, and you don't have to grill it to death, so you still have the tenderness, and, you know, it's just really delicious. And, of course, with tongue, you have so many different textures and, you know, different, I guess, flavors, too, you know, very rich, kind of more. We love it, yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess I'm trying to point out that there's a huge variety of different recipes. It's not just a, you know, steak on the Barbie here.
But the great thing about it, and let's as we conclude, let's remind everybody of this. You will need some selected ingredients you probably don't have that you're going to be able to get from Amazon and from wherever. Right. Other ingredients, the meat, the vegetables, the fish, poultry, these are all recognizable pieces of meat that you're going to be able to go buy
at your local grocery store.
Or your local supermarket or wherever it is. And that's the magic of this book. It's an intersection between the umami-producing sauces and marinades and the conventional foods that all too often we just, I guess we get bored with those flavors. And here's a way of enlivening the flavor and adding excitement to something that ordinarily would be just every day. So aside from a wonderful contribution to introducing the wide variety of Japanese grilling to Americans, you've done us a great service in saying it's within easy reach for you to do it too.
I think so. I mean, I do it. So if I can do it, you can do it.
Harris, it's been really cool talking to you.
Thank you guys so much for having me on your show.
And I can hardly wait to try this. And the squid recipe looks pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that I'll be putting this book to good use.
Well, thank you, guys.
And much success with it, because you deserve it.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back right after another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back and we're
with the devilish duo, I might add.
Yes, yeah.
These are Paula Deen's two sons called the Deen Brothers, who wrote a book called Fire It Up, right? And I think they were kind of firing it up in South Beach when we were talking to them.
It sounded like it, but we can't let the Japanese have the last word in grilling after all.
No.
So we've got a couple of good old American experts for you right here.
And I can tell you, actually, that one of the brothers, the one who's not married, has a girlfriend who looks very hot in an orange bikini.
Jamie and Bobby Deen are prolific cookbook writers, taking after their mother. Does anybody know who that might be? There's one very famous Deen called Paula. You two must have had an absolute ball growing up with your mother, who's so enthusiastic and has such a big personality.
Yes, ma'am. You know, I smile whenever you even bring that up. Bobby and I are so fortunate to have grown up in the house with Mom, of course, her cooking and her sense of humor. And I have not been hungry since 1971. I'm a very funny man.
Now, we don't know which one that was. Who was that?
That was Jamie, the heavier of the two brothers.
No, Jamie the heavier.
You two are too much.
No, that's Jamie of the quieter voice. Remember what I asked you, Jamie? You got to use your hog calling voice or whatever it is. Now this book brings new meaning to the word Georgia, and new meaning to the Georgia Bulldog, which is a friend of one of you. I'm not sure whose dog that is.
He is a friend. This is Bobby speaking, and the Georgia Bulldog is a friend to us both. The dog that you see in the book was a gift, is the word that I use. Jamie might choose a different word, but was a gift to Jamie from me.
Anchor.
We live in Savannah, Georgia, and the University of Georgia Bulldog mascot and the people who own and raise those dogs also live in Savannah.
Okay, that's the reason why. Okay.
And for Christmas a couple of years ago, you know, we've gotten to the age where it's like, my brother's got everything, so what can I give him? And I thought that the best and most unique gift would be to call this family and say, could I please get a bulldog that comes from the lineage of the University of Georgia mascot.
Uh-huh.
I did exactly that. The dog in the book is twice removed from from two mascots ago, the University of Georgia. That's a bit confusing, but he is. That is a University of Georgia Bulldog in the book.
That's important.
I'll tell you what I don't have is a clean carpet.
Now, what's his name?
His name is Champ. His birth name, his God-given name, is Lawrence Champion Walker.
There you go.
Champ, but he's affectionately known as the pig.
I'm sure. when I tell you that...
He just barked when I said his name.
The reason I asked the question is that my a friend that I play tennis with has naming rights on the dog that his wife buys. And they had a Bernese Mountain Dog, which is very dumb, who was called Voltaire. and their current dogs, which are fine show quality spaniels, are called Guinness and Winston.
Nice.
So you can see now that
regal name. Regal name.
Yeah. So you can see why I had asked the question.
Yes.
Now I think we ought to mention this because because she's a friend also, but she's also a really talented writer. You've worked on all. This is your fourth book, all of your books, with Melissa Clark, who is a food writer who's turned out a number of cookbooks and other books on her own.
Isn't it funny? We never actually said why we were interviewing the Dean brothers. we just thought it'd be nice to talk to you guys because we didn't have anything else to do today.
No, I started out by saying they look like they're having so much fun in these photographs that I'm jealous. I want to come play with you guys.
But you didn't say it was in a book. It's in a book called The Dean Brothers
Get Fired Up. Which, as you can figure out, is about grilling, tailgating, picnicking, and more. And it's color coordinated.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yeah,
I never figured that out.
Well, I'm not surprised.
My brother's in a fit.
Explain it to us. What each of these chapters is.
Well, Bobby and I felt like it was a natural way to break the book up. It's kind of every element that we experience in spring, summer, and fall, and that we're at the beach or at a picnic or we're tailgating at a sporting event or we're outside in the yard.
You're outside guys, right? Yeah, I mean,
we are. You know, in Savannah, Georgia, Bobby and I are so fortunate. Our summers are very, very long here.
And hot and humid.
It is hot and humid, but it's better than frozen and freezing. So,
we agree with you.
Our outside time, the low country is just a beautiful part of the country. We're so lucky to live here, and we enjoy spending time with family and friends. So this book is kind of, you know, how we're going to spend the next 4 or 5 months. Right now, and how we spent the previous 2 months as well. We've just been blessed with beautiful early spring weather here.
Well, no, let's move through. Let's see, the first one is, and I should mention that you have, throughout the book, you have sections called tips, which, I mean, is pretty self-explanatory, except they're actually very useful tips. And also, what are these pages called where you give the little background information? With the little plaid and the different colors.
You know, I'd have to look. That's a great question, Bobby. It's your turn to answer.
I'm sorry, Katie and I were very quietly speaking to one another while she was talking.
Uh huh. Well,
yeah, we ladies and gentlemen of our audience, you must understand that I understand there's a movie star in one of the rooms. And she's
very distracting.
And she's wearing just a modicum of clothes, just to make sure that.
She's wearing a fluorescent orange bikini, and we are in the Gulf of Mexico. So I'm on vacation. B, I'm with the most beautiful woman that exists.
Oh, that's great.
Sorry, I was distracted when you were talking about the whatever it was that you were just talking about.
And it sounds like you might even be close to being underwater.
I'm not far from it.
Those little plaid pages there are just a kind of a little throwaway recipe. Is not the correct term, but it relates to some things that we enjoyed growing up. That I know one of them is a dish that I learned to prepare when I was in the Boy Scouts, and it just gives a little bit of backstory about some of the things that we've enjoyed.
Yeah, well, some of them are explanations, or like how to tell when meat is done.
Yes, ma'am. It's you know, that's a big mistake that people make when they grill is. For people's fear of getting undercooked, unless that's the way you prefer it, especially when you're working with pork and chicken, and you know, for that we recommend thermometers to check your meat. But for a steak, the webbing between your thumb and index finger, the outer portion there where it's the most soft, it really feels like a rare steak. And the further you go up into that joint, when you get up near the bone and that firmness, that's how a medium well to well done steak feels. So you can practice on your fingers and get pretty proficient at knowing when a steak is your preferred temperature. The biggest mistake you can make would be to take a knife to a steak on the grill, to peel it back and check the inside. You lose all your juice, and that'll dry your steak out. So, you know, that's one of the tips that we have in the book that'll help make everyone a better cook outside.
How about picking? Let's go through these different categories and pick a recipe that you think is either a particular favorite of yours, or something a little bit different that it would be somebody should know about. Like, starting with on the grill, which is like the backyard, right?
Right. Yes,
well,
ma'am.
There are two, and this is Bobby speaking, there are two that I think may be a little different for people. First is one that we call a beer in the rear chicken. Have you seen that recipe yet?
Yeah, we do that one. You mean the beer can one?
Yeah, you do that?
Oh, yeah.
No, the funny part about it is there's a guy who, first of all, his friend wrote a book called The Zen of Beer Can Chicken.
Yeah, we interviewed him years ago.
And then he actually made a device so that you don't actually have to use a beer can. And the method involves sticking something right inside the bird, that's for sure, but underneath that is a reservoir. So you fill the reservoir with the beer, and then the beer goes up the spout and soaks the chicken.
Well, maybe it's not as unique as I thought, and I think maybe I'm just going to start jamming a six-pack in the chicken, and that'll
there you go. Then you'll one up my system. But
it'll be something nobody's ever seen.
But it is actually the most wonderful way to make sure that your chicken is moist.
It is. It gives it a really, really great flavor. And there's another recipe in there where we incorporate a sausage and a turkey breast. Have you seen that?
I didn't see that, but
no,
I have to say you like stuffing things a lot. And I mean, there's almost nothing, including fillet of beef, a fillet mignon. You stuff it with things.
With crab meat, I believe in that recipe.
No, it was more complicated, but I'll find it.
Now we'll have to give you a recommended recipe for your next book. Which is the famous Australian delicacy called a carpet bag steak.
Ah, where you
cut the filet mignon and you put oysters inside.
A whole filet.
Well, it doesn't matter. Any size piece will do. It's a matter of how many oysters you have to stuff in it.
I love that idea. We do an oyster dressing down in the South. I don't know if you've ever had that before, but at Thanksgiving time, a traditional cornbread dressing our mom
right.
makes with oysters in it. That's a really, really neat recipe.
Okay, well, and let's see, we're getting good recipes. Tailgating, and that means you have to actually transport things, right?
Yes, ma'am, that's kind of the challenge unless you're fortunate enough to live in a city that has a sports team that you enjoy following. And we have a minor league baseball team here in Savannah, so we do a little of that here. But we follow the University of Georgia Bulldogs, and that's 4 hours away.
Mm.
So, you know, I think is the extravagance of your tailgate is in direct relation to your age. I think the younger folks can tailgate with a cooler and be happy. and then you see the older folks that really enjoy putting out a table and setting it and go to the trouble of carrying a grill. But there's lots of dishes that you can prepare at the house. Cold salads and things like that that transport easily, that helps make cleanup a little bit easier. And, you know, if we've gotten older, though, I'm not afraid to break out the grill and do some different things. We've got a big section of hamburgers with different flavors and hot dogs in this book. So, you know, it not only looks like summer, it tastes a lot like summer, too.
Of course, if you were tailgating in Pittsburgh, you'd have to strip off your shirt in the middle of winter and paint yourself gold and black.
My girlfriend went to school at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh.
Oh, great.
Well, then you
just
must.
Side note.
Yeah, you must ask her about the real professional tailgaters in Pittsburgh.
I will ask her about the real professional tailgating. I'm sure that she's got some good tips.
I bet she does too.
They actually semi-shut them down because they used to arrive at like 7 o'clock in the morning and each one would take over three parking spaces. And when they built the new stadium, they didn't have nearly as much parking, so that they said, you can't come in here and tailgate. Well, needless to say, the guys found a way around that.
Of course. Because the number of patrons didn't change.
No, it's full all the time. No, it's full. No question about it.
Well, now, what's the difference then between tailgating and picnicking, which is your next section?
Well, there is no sports event at a picnic. You can play sports with yourself, but this is more of in a grassy area that's traditionally done, I think, closer to home. Of course, we have the beaches here, and Savannah's got I don't know how many beautiful squares downtown. So it's more of just a green space. And our son Jack is 5 years old. He loves for us to spread out a blanket. And so we picnic here in our yard a lot. So I think that's the big difference.
But these are portable. You know,
somebody's black and gold.
You know, one thing I want out of this whole book is I want somebody to make me a cucumber sangria.
Doesn't that look so good?
Oh, yes. It looks like it has pickle juice in it.
Not pickle juice, I don't believe.
No.
You know what's funny is that we've been to so many different hotels in our travel, and there's always water in the lobby that's got fruits and vegetables in it. And it's always so pretty. And it's an easy thing for us, you know, to put some fruits or Rookie, my wife is expecting our second son next week, and she's drinking tons of water.
Uh-huh.
And she loves the cucumber water or mint water or, you know, with just lemon water. So, you know, it's an easy way to make something old new by adding texture to different drinks.
Uh-huh.
Well, you are a couple of really thoughtful guys.
Yeah, I mean,
Who would have thought it?
Why?
Who would have thought they would be so thoughtful?
Why?
I can select a large number of adjectives for your mother, but thoughtful would not be on the list.
No, I think she is.
Right. I'll take thoughtful.
You'll take thoughtful. Well, thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. The book is called?
Yes, it's called The Dean Brothers Get Fired Up. And you'll find in here Southern classics such as cheese straws. And then you'll find kind of strange things like this cucumber drink that I just mentioned. And also the hamburger with peanuts I thought was kind of interesting. It's just filled with you'll have fun with the book. And you'll enjoy watching people have fun cooking.
And besides, we can't talk any more about the book because Han just dropped it on the floor.
I can talk about it. It's a great book, and you'll love it.
Thank you so much. Bobby and Jamie,
thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank y'all very much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
So now you hear the results of editing a track where at least one of the guests was, we think, was probably in the water in Florida with his girlfriend in the bikini. But They're good guys
and it's a good book.
And I'm sure you're going to get some great tips. So we've done some grilling, we've done some butchering, and we've made some coffee. What a busy week we've had. So we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.